Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Hello, folks, and welcome into this week's edition of Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro. And the four hitters that I've got on my lineup card this week are ones the National League wished they had. No better leadoff guy in the game than our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry. This week, episode number 100 that Tom has been a part of, and I can't thank him enough for all the great content that he has given to this show over the years. Now, as a leadoff hitter, he's not going to steal you any bases, but he's a great station-to-station guy. So he's the perfect guy, like I say, to lead off this week's show. TP and I are going to look back at last week's Scottish Open and Robert McIntyre's huge win. They're so happy for him. What a great win as a Scotsman to win the Scottish Open. We'll also look back to the ISCO Championship and ahead to this week's Open Championship. Tom will join me here in just a moment. Speaking of the Open, 1989 Open champion Mark Calcavecchia is going to be back on the show this week. So excited to have Mark as a part of the show. We'll look back to his remarkable victory 35 years ago on the same course that they're playing this week, Royal Troon. We'll also hear about the clutch birdie putt he made on the 72nd hole to get into a playoff with Greg Norman and Wayne Grady. The incredible slam dunk hole out that he had on the 12th hole that really got his round turned around and giving him a shot at getting into that playoff. We'll also talk about his go-for-it mentality, plus who he likes this year at the Open Championship. He'll be along about 25 minutes from now. Then leading off part two of this week's show is going to be Jay Delsing. I love Jay. Jay is such a positive influence in our game. Just a wonderful former player and now host. We'll talk about that a little bit. We'll also go back to his stellar college golf career at UCLA. He won a couple of times out on the Korn Ferry Tour. Finished in the top 10 30 times during the course of his tour career. He's also, like I say, got a wonderful radio show and podcast called Golf with Jay Delsing. We'll hear about his experience as well playing in an Open Championship. He was in the 1995 Open that was played at St. Andrews. That's the year that John Daly won. I'll also get his insights on the Open Championship this week, plus the work he's doing for the Children's Miracle Network. Looking forward to having Jay back as part of the show as well. Then we'll round out the show with one of the top U.S. kids instructors in the game, James Hong. James came highly recommended by both Jeff Smith, who's a wonderful friend of the show, and Tom Patry as well, because of the positive impact that James is having on our junior players. We'll hear about his approach, how he makes the game fun and one for a lifetime for kids, plus get some tips for how we can work on our games at home. I'm looking forward to having James as part of the show. He'll round things out in part two. So, folks, another great show on tap for you this week. Thank you so much for being here, tuning in, making Next on the Tee a part of your weekly golf content, and taking the journey with me again this week.
Okay, before I bring TP into the show, I want to start off by talking about the great people over at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company and Iron City Beer, a company that I have loved my entire life and have been drinking since I was 21 years old, of course. Whether you're a hacker or a scratcher, the secret to a successful day on the links is knowing when it's time to grab an iron, even if that means keeping it in the bag till the 19th hole. If it's been a while since you've reached for Pittsburgh staple beer, it's time to revisit Iron City. Thanks to their incredible new facility in Creighton, the best tasting Iron City beer ever made is now available at a course near you. Iron City pairs well with any lie and sky and serves as a friendly reminder that there's always next round. Iron City Beer, best enjoyed while enjoying life. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddies trip locations When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen, Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You got to see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade. From the very beginning, P790 irons have been rooted in clean aesthetics and thoughtful design. However, their true beauty is found beneath the surface. With AI-optimized weighting and speed foam air on the inside, every iron is uniquely designed to perform exactly how you need it to. As striking as they are on the outside, their true beauty lies within. Learn more about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade by checking out their website at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Okay, now back in the house for the 100th time is our resident director of instruction, Tom Petrie. 100 times. I'm either very blessed or an idiot, and I'm going to leave that judgment up to all of you. Tom first joined me back on November 7th in 2015. So not only has it been 100 times, it's almost been 9 years, but I couldn't be more honored to say again for the 100th time. Good evening, TP. How are you, my friend?
Chrissy, boy!
That was a good one for number 100.
Holy, 100, this is really 100?
100 times, my
friend. It's impossible.
It does seem like it, doesn't it?
And what was the date, the original date?
November 7, 2015.
9 years ago.
Well, almost 9 years, my friend.
I was in my mid-50s. Now I'm in my late 60s.
But you only look, you know, a minute over 60, really. I mean, let's be honest.
A minute over 100. Go ahead, keep going.
Indeed. TP, what's going on with you, my friend? How have things been?
Everything's good, Chrissy. We're in the middle of I'd have to tell you, you're in the South too, but what an incredible hot summer this has been. It's been unbelievable. I played with my good buddy, John Budenhagen, in the South Florida PGA Pro Junior about 2 weeks ago, and you know, it was a scorching, you know, like 107 degree heat index. It was unbelievable, but every day seems like it's been like that. It's been a brutal summer heat wise, man. Just unbelievable.
Yeah, with you. I understand how you feel, my friend.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk. We're in Open Championship week, and I want to, before we get into all of that, I want to touch on something quickly. Last Sunday in the ISCO Championship in Lexington, Kentucky, you've been telling me for, well, over a year now, how good Pearson Coody is and he's going to be. Had a chance to get his first PGA Tour victory on Sunday, came up a little bit short, lost in a playoff to Harry Hall on the third playoff hole, but he was knocking on the door. Is he about to emerge, do you think?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, Chris, and I did tout him pretty hard last year, and he's been, and I'm not knocking him at all, but he's been a little bit disappointing this year. He's had a really kind of a rough up and down year. That certainly so far has been the highlight. I wouldn't get too excited yet. That wasn't exactly a deep, well-known field. I mean, but they did shoot, what were they, 23 under or 22 under to get in the playoff. So he obviously played really, really well. It looks like in the last couple of weeks he may have turned the corner a little bit. Understand he's got some kind of a minor shoulder injury too. So I'm not really sure that he's there yet, but certainly that was an encouraging performance.
Yeah, but, you know, to your point, and I get that it wasn't the deep field because a lot of the guys are overplaying in the Scottish Open, but you got to take advantage of your opportunities when you get them.
No doubt.
So,
no doubt, yeah.
So he absolutely did that, it felt like.
That way, you know, he helped pay the rent for the month, you know, maybe pay his mortgage payment, his car payment, maybe for the cell phone. But, Yeah, I mean, he played, I mean, listen, you know, 22 or 23 under. I'm not sure, no matter who was there, they would have shot many more under. But, you know, let's see what the next couple of weeks bring after the after all the boys come back stateside, see how he does.
What did you think about Robert McIntyre going out and winning his home country's Open? He wins the Scottish Open. Last year finished a shot behind Rory. This time gets it done by draining a long birdie putt on the 72nd hole. A Scotsman winning on his home soil. I thought it was fantastic.
You know, Robert McIntyre, I think we should call him Bobby McIntyre. Bobby, we should call him Bobby. unbelievable performance. I mean, to play that way at home, and he got, you know, really Rory stole that from him last year at the, you know, at the 24th hour. Obviously played great at the Canadian Open, and now has won the Scottish. And it's so hard to play well at home, man. It's so hard to play, you know, well in front of your own folks. I mean, great performance. Kid is a really good player, and he's really gutsy. Hangs in there. And he's a bit of a character too, so it's kind of fun to watch him. I'm definitely a Robert McIntyre fan for sure.
Yeah, he certainly won me over with that performance. Again, last year at the Scottish Open, played really, really well. Got him on my radar, but boy, what a great win! I was so happy for him.
Yeah, very cool, very cool win.
He ended up beating Adam Scott of all people by a stroke. It was also kind of nice to see Adam Scott back at the top of a leaderboard.
Yeah, I got to agree with that. I mean, how. If you don't like Adam Scott, there's something wrong with you. I mean, just a class act, you know, one of the really, really great golfers on the planet. And obviously, he suffers from time to time with the flat stick, but played really, really well and such a good ball striker and a good player in tough conditions. So maybe a little boost of confidence going into Troon this week.
Another thing that I loved about McIntyre's finish was not only how excited he got when he won, but I don't know if you saw Sahith Theegala, who ended up finishing tied for fourth, stuck around, and he's out there in the crowd to see how the tournament would finish and being genuinely excited and happy for McIntyre and posting his congratulations on social media. And the PGA Tour social media account has a picture of McIntyre going crazy there on the 18th green when that putt drops. And in the background, you see Theegala with his arms raised, standing on a balcony. I love the sportsmanship of Theegala sticking around to see how it went. And then obviously, with the excitement he had for McIntyre, I thought that was a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, it's pretty classy, isn't it? I mean, so he is somebody I do not know at all, but by all accounts, the guys that I know that do know him think he's a really wonderful human being, just a solid guy, and just a good human being. So that was very, very cool. Anytime players hang around like that, I think that's a great gesture.
Yeah, me too. Rory seemed in good spirits at his press conference prior to the start of the Scottish Open. He got drilled with a lot of questions, as you would expect, because we haven't seen him since he was at Pinehurst. And then so he gets a lot of questions about those two short missed putts. And the thing that I like most about how he responded is how he realized that he needs to appreciate all the great things that he has achieved in the game and learn from why he missed those putts and move on. And I think that's exactly what we all need to do. I think it's a great message for all of us. Focus on the positive things that you've done and let go of the negative things. What do you think about what you saw from him at that press conference and then earlier this week at his press conference at the Open?
You mean the press conference that he didn't post up at the Open? Is that one? That's what I think about Rory right there. No comment.
Okay,
you know
moving
how,
on.
Chris, you know how I feel about what happened there. I mean, Rory McIlbush has disappointed on too many occasions. And I still believe, and I've said this before off air, I think he kind of talks out of both sides of his mouth a little bit. Rory has disappointed me in some of the things he's done too many times. I'm just not on that train.
All right, let's look ahead to this week. Rory obviously is coming in on good form. He finished tied for fourth at the Scottish Open, as did Colin Morikawa, who won the Open back in 2021. Brian Harman, who's the defending champion, has been playing all right. He's been hovering around 20th to 25th most of the season. Cam Smith, who won it back in 2022, he finished 6th last week on the LIV Tour over in Valderrama, Spain. Scottie Scheffler is obviously the odds-on favorite. He's 5-1. Rory's 8-1. Ludvig Åberg and Xander Schauffele are 12-1. Bryson is at 14-1. So who do you like, Tom?
You know, Chris, as you know, before I give you a name, everything is based on tee times and the draw and weather. You know, I mean, you can get you can get really hosed with the wrong early, late, or late early based on weather conditions. So there's always an element at this tournament, luck of the draw a little bit in terms of tee times and weather and what goes on during the day on the coast out there. I played that golf course twice, and it really kind of lulls you to sleep a little bit. The first four holes are kind of mundane, and then you get to the 15, all hell breaks loose, and you better put your bootstraps on. But I think, you know, guys coming in there in good form is really important. So I like Ludwig a lot, Aberg. I mean, I think the kid is a really good player. He disappointed the last round of Pinehurst, but he's got a lot of game, and he's really shown up a lot of times this year. Adam Scott coming in there in good form is a good ball striker, and the guy who knows how to play in the wind, being Australian, is certainly somebody you pay attention to. I think there's a lot of guys playing good coming in. It's so hard this tournament because of weather and the draw to pick somebody. I don't know. I think Oberg would be a great story. What do you think?
No, I'm with you. I mean, it certainly would be a great story. I mean, he's won once and he's been around the tops of leaderboards and some of the other majors, right? We finished second at the Masters. So look, he's a wonderful emerging young guy. Yeah. I think he's going to do, you know, I think he's going to be a beast in this game. So it's going to be interesting. If he was to go out and win a Claret Jug, I mean, I, you know, look out, oof, right?
Yeah, it'd be pretty cool. I mean, yeah,
the monster is out.
I just think there's so many guys that, you know, are so talented. It's so deep out there now, Chris. You know what I mean? And even a guy who's off form, you know, you get that one spark, you make that one good swing, you get that one good feel, you hole a good putt, you know, out of the gate somewhere, and your confidence changes, and you, all of a sudden you ride the momentum. You know, we've seen that happen so many times. A guy that was off the radar screen, all of a sudden, you know, boom, has a great week. It's so hard to pick this one with the weather conditions changing.
So we always say when we get to the Masters that it doesn't begin until the back nine on Sunday. To your point about weather, it seems like until we see what the weather conditions are on Sunday, that's kind of when the tournament starts, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if they have great weather all week long, and I think we'd all be disappointed if they did, because one of the things we love about the Open is the fact that they do get so much weather and you can have all four seasons in the round of golf. We right. want to see it to be cloudy and rainy and windy, and maybe it dies down and then it comes back up and all of that sort of thing. We're sort of rooting for that. And I think we'd all be disappointed if it didn't happen. Is that really what it comes down to, is what's the weather going to be like on Sunday? And from what I've seen from the forecast, Tom, Saturday, rain and windy, Sunday, cloudy and windy. That's what we want.
Yeah. You know, and again, that golf course, Chris, my experience at least is I played it on a very, very calm day. And I played it on a day that was just brutal. And again, the first four holes are very mundane, and then it all starts to happen. The back nine in particular is a great, great nine holes of golf, and it's hard. But we've seen a very low score win there in the Stenson Phil situation. And
yes.
we've seen some high scores win there, you know, just a couple under. So again, you know, based on conditions And I don't know what the place is like going into the Open. Has it been dry there? Has it been wet there? Is it soft? Is it firm? I haven't really watched that closely yet. I got to get my Open Championship hat on and dive in a little bit. But, you know, the conditions there are everything. And no matter what the forecast is, here's the other thing I remember. No matter what the forecast is, it can change on a dime. It can, you know, mm-hmm. it can be a fine and all of a sudden you're on the seventh hole and it's supposed to be a nice day, and all of a sudden all hell breaks loose. You know, it changes so fast because of the proximity to the water. So the forecast isn't always accurate either. So anything could happen there.
You know, most of the courses on the Open Road have holes that are famous unto themselves. St. Andrews has the Road Hole in the Valley of Sin, short of 18. Calamity Quarter at Royal Portrush. And we get the Postage Stamp, which is right. the eighth hole at Royal Troon this year. It's all of 123 yards. When they asked Tiger about it, he simply said, hit the ball on the green. That's it. Green good, miss green bad. And the green is only 420 square feet. And to give everyone perspective on that, according to an article in the Golf Digest, you could fit that green into the average green on the PGA Tour 14 times.
and there's runoff on all sides, deep bunkers. You've obviously played it twice, as you said. What should we look forward to seeing at the postage stamp?
Well, I got two comments on two different holes in this golf course. One, the postage stamp. I was, first time I stood on the tee there, there was a little left or right crosswind, and you look down there and you're like, that is the smallest target I've ever seen in my life. And I was fortunate enough to hit one on the green and make a putt and make a two there. And then the second time I played, I hit it on the right edge of the green and spun it off the green into that bunker on the right. And that might be the deepest bunker I've ever stood in my life. Not that I'm a giant, because at 5'9", I'm not exactly towering over anybody, but I felt like I was subterranean. It was unbelievable. And luckily had a decent lie and was able to get it out and keep it on the green and make four. But I could see knocking into that right bunker and getting a not so good lie, and you could be in there for the rest of your life. And then contrary to that, if you miss the green left, there's this nice little mound over there with grass that's about, you know, deep enough to hide a small child in, and you can get over there and chop it around for the rest of your life, and then chop it out and run it across the green down in that bunker, because that green is tilted. I mean, it's a little bugger of a hole, man. It's so little, but when you stand on that tee, I don't care how good a player you are, and you got a gap wedge or some kind of short wedge in your hand, you're just thinking, man, just please land on the surface somewhere. Please land on the surface, because anything around that green is no bueno. And then the other hole I wanted to comment on, Chris, is number 10, which is runs along a railway track. And when you stand on the championship tee at number 10, you're looking at these two giant mounds in front of you. No definition in the foreground, like not a tree to aim at or something like that. And you really don't have a freaking clue when that ball leaves the face, whether it's in the fairway or not. And it's a long golf hole. You have a long second shot in, and the green is perched right against the railway track. I mean, you feel like your face is on the track when you're standing over there hitting a putt. It's a hell of a golf hole. And some people would think it unfair because, you know, the blind tee shot and the lack of definition, but it's a great golf hole. And boy, you better just hope that the thing lands in the fairway there and that you can get your club on the ball for the second shot, because that's another green that is really, really hard to look at from the middle of the fairway and just say, please get on the ground somewhere where I can putt it, please.
Let's take that a step further, Tom, because it is a completely different game playing links golf to what we're used to here in the States, right? It's a lower trajectory game over there. It's a bump and run game. Typically here, we're trying to hit the ball as high as we can and land it soft. But there, you're trying to keep it low and on the ground. So transitioning from one thing to another, I get why the guys go over there to play the Scottish Open.
Absolutely.
Some of it is to get a practice round, right, and on a link style golf course. But talk about trying to take your game here and really completely do a different thing over there. Does it play in the favor of guys that play in the wind? Is it a Texas players kind of, you know, you got an advantage if you're a Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth, because you're used to playing in the wind growing up and as you went through college and that sort of thing? And is it a European player's advantage to where a Rory or a Shane Lowry really does have a bit of advantage on the rest of the field?
No, I think, Chris, I think that's a great point. I mean, if you don't have a lot of links experience and you're over there for the first time, you're certainly at a disadvantage. I mean, a big time. I mean, you could be at a shot around or two shots around disadvantage. And it's that different. And growing up and playing in those conditions and playing on that kind of a ground is certainly an advantage. It always kind of surprised me that Rory hit the ball so high and didn't really hit a lot of flighted shots coming from where he came from. But certainly guys that, listen, back to Bobby McIntyre, I mean, coming off of a win, playing well at the Canadian, you know, winning there and then being on a link-style golf course, you know, that's just normal. That's very normal to him and doesn't really ruffle his feathers at all. But if you haven't played in that kind of condition or don't have a lot of experience in that kind of condition, I'll call you a vanilla American player, that takes some experience and takes some getting used to. It's a different animal. It's a very different animal.
And as we've talked about weather,
The other thing that I would think would take some getting used to is you're layering up over there. Again, you could get all four seasons in a round of golf. You got your rain gear on. You may have a sweater or a vest or something. Now, all of a sudden, you're a little bit bulky. Is that something that takes some getting used to? Because that's going to impact your swing, is it not?
And listen, you said the high one day was 67. Is that warm over there? Well, 67 sounds very pleasant. But remember, all these guys who are coming over from the States right now have been in the middle of one of the hottest seasons ever, hottest summer seasons on tour ever. And they've been sweating their ass off and been, you know, just absolutely brutally hot. And now all of a sudden, 67 is going to feel like 47. You know, it's going to feel that the ball is going to react differently. You're going to feel differently. Your hands are going to feel different on the club. Your hands are going to feel different on the putter. It's definitely going to be different. And it does take getting used to, and it is a transition. And like you said, we start putting layers on, and you're not feeling as loose and as free swinging like you had when you were playing in 105 degrees somewhere. It's different, man, and it's hard to just flip that switch from one week to the next.
Yeah, and 67 is the high, right? To your point about the advantage of the draw, right. You're early morning on Thursday right. or Friday, right? Now it's 50 degrees. Right. And on Saturday, if you're going to get, you know, wind and rain, that 50 is going to feel like 30.
Right. It's going to be different.
Yeah, it's going to be very different. And then on top of that, I think it becomes a mental thing, right? Who is mentally tough enough to not have to think about that and put that aside and know that everyone is going to have to play in this and they can go out there and do it?
I think that's a really, really, really good point, Chris. And it shows how great your golf IQ is. It's so happy that you're making all these wonderful points. You're a golf genius. Golf genius.
Feel free to spread that rumor.
I will spread that all over.
I appreciate you.
No, it's definitely. I mean, you're right. It's gonna be, you know, if you get that, you know, 7 o'clock tee time, you know, those early tee times you get in the Open Championship time, and it's all of a sudden it's 52 degrees and it's damp and raw and it's blowing a little bit, and the last time you played golf in the States it was 103. it's a shock to the system, man, and all of a sudden. You know, hit a really solid one. It feels like it comes off the face just dead, you know, and you're like, oh man, I got to change my field perspective here and quick.
Yeah. Couple more before I let you go. And I want to get a playing lesson from you because I need one.
You have money? Yeah. Do you have cash?
Feel free to Venmo me and I'll get that over to you.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah.
I want to get a putting tip, and here's something that I noticed when I've seen all of the close-up replays of Rory short putts at the U.S. Open. When we see a close-up of Rory putting, what you see is the blade of his putter is arcing up at contact, and he strikes the ball midway up the circumference of the golf ball. He said that's so the ball starts rolling end over end sooner instead of skidding for the first foot or so. I thought that's why we did a forward press to kind of get that top spin going. What's the best way to get our putts rolling online as soon as possible and not skidding for the first few feet?
Well, first a comment on Rory's putt on 18. You know, I've watched that thing. I've probably watched that now legitimately 30 or 40 times. You know, watched it, replayed it. To me, he comes up and out of it way too early and way too soon and hit up on the ball almost too much. And doesn't really make very solid contact with the golf ball, which doesn't allow it to hold its line, which clearly it didn't. I don't think you try to come up on the ball to produce top spin. I think what you do to get the ball rolling end over end, I think it's all a matter of setup, you know, where the ball's positioned. You know, any golf club does three things in the forward motion. It travels down for some period of time. It travels level with the ground for some period of time. And then it ascends at some period of time. So you put the ball in a position when you set up that's going to catch it just as the club head begins to ascend. And that naturally causes the strike you want and the ball rolling end over end as soon as possible that you'd like to see happen. So I think a lot of that is all set up. I think if your stroke is, you know, relatively solid, you know, the thing you've got to focus on is your setup condition. And I have never seen a face on view. Notice that you haven't seen any face-on views of that putt. You've all seen down the line views of that putt of Rory's. I'd really like to see a face-on view of that strike and see where that ball was positioned in the stance and if it was forward enough. I'm always preaching ball position as far as quality of contact and imparting the correct roll off the face when I teach putting.
Tom, before I let you go, remind our listeners again for the 100th time how they can get a hold of you, how they can find you on social media and follow you.
Well, Chris, just as you'd be inclined to say, who the hell wants to follow me? I mean, really. I mean, let's follow Next on the T on Tuesday night, and let's tune into Chris Mascaro. And by the way, give me your lineup tonight behind me here.
Mark Calcavecchia is waiting on the line. He'll be joining us next.
So let's start there.
Okay.
Calc is one of my all-time favorites, especially one of my favorite Gators of all time, one of the really good guys. And a past Open champion, and just you know, and I played some college golf with Calc, and I haven't seen him very much recently, but one of my all-time favorite guys, just a good dude, and you're blessed to have him on, and please say hi.
100%, I will.
Absolutely. And after him is who's after him?
Jay Delsing will join after Mark.
You got another guy, you know, a West Coast guy, I believe UCLA. Am I right?
That's correct.
And another gentleman, just a good dude, and you know, a grinder out there for a long time, got a lot out of his talent, and just a pleasure to be around. And then I know your last guy, Mr. Hong, and let me tell you something about James Hong. He is one of the superstar young teachers, and as well known as he probably is, he's not known enough. He's done some tremendous work with juniors in the New York metropolitan area. A great individual, super positive, super upbeat, and by the way, technically sound, really technically sound teacher. So you got a hell of a lineup there. Please say hi to all three for me.
I will be glad to do so. Very much looking forward to having James Hong on the show for the first time. Jeff Smith highly recommended him as well. So
great,
I'm looking
dude.
Forward to
great
that dude. Conversation. TP, take care, my friend. All the best to you and the missus. I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Chris, you're the best, man. Have a great night.
You too. Take care, Tom. That is the great Tom Patry. They don't come better. I've said it 100 times, and I hope I get to say it at least another 100 times. Be sure to give him a follow on Instagram, at Tom Patry Golf, the website, TomPatry.com, and be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel. Over 300 free video lessons waiting for you right there. And Tom is just one of the best people you get to meet in this life, and he's been a great friend to me for a long time. Can't thank him enough for being on the show 100 times, coming back in all the great content that he has shared with all of us since, like I say, November of 2015. So I'm looking forward to celebrating our 9-year anniversary together here on the show in November. And I'm already looking forward to when he'll be back on the show with me again here in a couple of weeks. Coming up next is going to be 1989 Champion Golfer of the Year and one of my all-time favorite guests, Mark Calcavecchia. Before I bring Mark into the show, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year, and I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe, and I need all the help I can get, and the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I also want to give a shout-out to my friends over at On Point Golf and their great On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thong Chai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an on-point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use on-point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Okay, now back with me is a guy who's become a wonderful friend and that I enjoy immensely, and that is 1989 Open champion Mark Calcavecchia. Let me remind you a little bit about Mark's background. He's from Laurel, Nebraska. His family moved to West Palm Beach, Florida when he was 13. He won the Florida High School Golf Championship in 1977. Like Tom Patry mentioned a moment ago, he played his college golf at the University of Florida from 1978 to 1980. He was named All-SEC in 1979, and that season Mark won the Furman Invitational. He turned pro in 1981, got his first win on the PGA Tour at the 1986 Southwest Golf Classic. Mark has one of the lowest scoring rounds to par in PGA Tour history. He finished 28 under par, a four-round total of 256 at the 2001 Waste Management Open, which featured a second round 60. At the 2009 Canadian Open, he set the record by making 9 consecutive birdies during his second round. In all, Mark has won 13 times out on the PGA Tour, including that 1989 Open Championship at Royal Troon, which he won in a playoff over Greg Norman and Wayne Grady. He's won 4 times out on the Champions Tour, and over the course of his career, he has 193 top 10 finishes, 351 top 25s. He's a fantastic follow out on Twitter, at Mark Calc, and I couldn't be more thrilled. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Mark, thanks for coming back on the show.
Good evening, Chris. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Mark, how are you, my friend?
Great. It was fun listening to Tom Patry. I've known Tom forever. And super cool that this is his 100th appearance on your show.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, that's a credit to him, but mostly you. that's awesome. That's so awesome.
Yeah, it is. I can't thank him enough. Mark, here we are. It's Open Championship Week back at the site where you won it at 89. This has got to be a special week for you, not only thinking back on perhaps the greatest victory in your PGA Tour career, but just also getting to see the course again on TV and remembering all the great shots you hit that week.
Yeah, it is pretty exciting. You know, obviously I love that course, and I've been talking to Eric Cole, my buddy, a little bit, who's playing there for the first time. And, you know, he's played about 12 weeks in a row, so he's kind of tired, but he says he loves the course. It's in great shape. You know, so far the weather's holding out. They're supposed to get some rain on and off, I guess, throughout the week. But, I think it's going to be, an amazing, amazing week, and a great tournament.
Yeah. Tom and I were talking about the weather, and always plays a factor in any Open Championship, and we wanted to. I think we want to see that sort of thing. That's one of the things we love about an Open is you get the opportunity to see the guys play perhaps and all four seasons during the course of a round, or certainly the course of the tournament. And when I was looking back at your win in 89, they described the final round as hot and sunny. Do you recall it being hot and sunny?
Well, I don't know about hot, but it was exactly what you just described. We don't want to watch as fans. It was a beautiful week all week. It was, you know, probably around 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Sunny the whole week. They were in a drought. I think on Saturday there was actually a fire right of 6 fairway. It was so dry. It was a perfect week of weather. But the course held its own. We were only 13 under, and the course is playing short and really hard, bouncy. Yeah, it was a nice week of weather for sure.
Heading into the final round, you were tied for fourth. Wayne Grady had the lead at 12 under. Tom Watson was second at 11 under. Payne Stewart third at 10 under. And Grady was a good player. He'd go on to win the PGA Championship the next year. Tom Watson had won his 5 Opens by that point, but he was always a factor in any Open Championship through 2009 when he nearly won it again at age 59. And Payne had three top tens going into that Open in 89 and would go on to win the PGA Championship the next month. So you had some heavyweights in front of you on the leaderboard. Did you have a number in mind that you thought you were going to need to go out there and shoot? Or did you go out in the final round and just let the tournament come to you?
Exactly. I really didn't think that, you know, I needed a number to shoot or a certain score to shoot. You know, I was playing well. I was confident. I'd won Phoenix and LA earlier in the year. And, you know, everything was just kind of, I was feeling great. Obviously, I was only 20 years old. So I was feeling good. And, you know, as the round went on, I played the front nine okay. And then when I made the loop around 8 through 12 or 11, I made a few bogeys and I was really struggling. And winning the tournament was the last thing on my mind, honestly. I was just trying to right the ship and get a top 10. And then, lo and behold, you know, I flew that chip in the hole on 12 from left of the green. And, you know, in a terrible spot where you couldn't get up and down even one time out of 10. But sure enough, it flew in the hole. And at that, when that happened, it just changed everything for me. My attitude, my energy level. I played the last 6 holes great. And then by the time I got to 16, Greg Norman was done. He birdied the first six holes that day, shot 64. And was in at 13 under, and I think Wayne Grady was still 15 under, and I was only 11 under on 16. So, like I said, you know, being 4 back with 2 to go or 3 to go isn't you're not really thinking about winning. But then I thought to myself, well, if I birdie 2 of the last 3, I can tie Greg, and then let's just see what Wayne's got coming down the stretch. And that's exactly what happened. And you know, then Wayne bogeyed the 2 par 3s in the back nine, and next thing I knew, I was in a playoff.
I want to go back to some of the holes that you just mentioned, because you hold a 40-footer on 11, and then to your point, you slam dunk one on 12, your second shot, you short-sighted yourself to the green. When those two things happen, you drain a long one, and then a shot that, you know, glasses half full said it was the most perfectly hit chip shot ever. When those two things happen, do you start to think to yourself at all, hey, maybe this is my day?
Not exactly. You know, when that kind of thing happens, you're just like on 11, I was in the left bushes, right bushes, left bushes, and then finally on the green, and I didn't even clean my ball. I had stickers sticking out of my arms. I'm telling you know, those gorse bushes are pretty sticky over there, and they hurt. You know, the last thing I was thinking about doing at that point was winning. And then when the chip flew in the hole in the next hole, I hit a bad drive, bad second shot. I'm over there short left of the green in the dirt with the pin was back left. Just no shot, really. But I remember I've seen the highlights of it. Obviously, I just kind of pulled my visor down over my head and just kind of was almost embarrassed about it. And oddly enough, I was playing with David Faraday. So if you can imagine that, the grief he probably gave me, I don't even really remember, but we still talk about it this day. But anyway, you know, then I just kind of knuckled down and just picked my spirits up so much. And because, like I said, I think I bogeyed 8 and 10 and made the lucky par putt on 11. Back then it was a par 5. Now it's a par 4. So that was for a 5. And then the chip went in on 12 and just everything changed after that. So there's definitely the golf gods are out there when you win majors or any tournament, really. And amazing things seem to happen when you win. And that was certainly it for me.
You briefly mentioned the 8th hole, otherwise known as the postage stamp. Only 123 yards, but one of the great holes in golf. Talk about what makes that hole so challenging.
It's an amazing hole. It's usually back into the wind because the first 7 holes are straight downwind, and then 8 goes back into the wind, and it's only 123 yards, but the greens a little bit wider in the front, and then as the pin gets, as the green goes on, it's like, it's shaped like a squash. It's kind of fat, well, not fat, it's still narrow, but it's wider in the front, and then it narrows in the back. And when the pin's in the back center, you literally only have 15 feet on each side of the hole to hit it. And if you don't, if you miss it, the left bunker, there's a name for it. I can't remember what it is other than death, but it, it's not good. And then when you miss it to the right, it goes straight down a hill into another bunker, but way down below the surface of the green. And you can't see anything from down there. And then you're just praying not to leave it in that bunker or hit it across the green into the other bunker. So, it's one of the great par threes in golf, and it is terrifying. It really is a nervous hole.
I got to imagine if the winds are up, I mean, you almost have no chance. I mean, it's just luck at that point if you got such a narrow landing area.
It's difficult. It really is. I've heard stories of guys hitting 6 and 7 irons into that green, just like the seventh hole at Pebble. You know, when the wind's howling into you, that hole is actually, much easier than the postage stamp. But both can be terrifying, when the wind's howling into you.
You ended up needing to birdie, like you said a little bit ago, 18, just to get into the playoff with Norman and Grady. You hit a great 8-iron shot that ended up a few feet from the hole, but you still had a knee knocker to make. What was it like for you? How do you block out the magnitude of the moment when you're lining up that putt and standing over it, knowing this is the tournament right here? If this doesn't go in, I'm going home.
Yeah, it was. And actually, over the 8-iron shot, and I drove it like 3 yards short of the bunker that Greg Norman ended up hitting it in the playoff. So getting back to the playoff, I knew that bunker was reachable. But anyway, in regulation on the 72nd hole, I knew I needed the birdie 18 to tie Greg to have any chance. And I actually got kind of nervous over my 8-iron shot, and I backed off it. And I rarely back off a shot. And I just told myself to keep doing what I've been doing for the last year or whatever. Just focus on your, you know, what you've been doing, what your swing, you know, what your swing thoughts were. And I zipped it in there at about 3 feet. And for some reason, when I got over the 3-footer, maybe 3.5 feet max, but probably 3 feet, I just felt really confident over it. I'd been putting great. I just, you know, it was like a left center putt. I just said, just drill this thing right in the back of the hole. And I do remember being very confident over the putt. With no negative thoughts. So that was nice. So I got that one in. And then, like I said, just, we waited for for Wayne Grady to see what happens. And he bogeyed, the 2 par 3s, 14 and 17. And, found myself in a playoff.
Yeah. And it was a 4-hole playoff, and Greg got off to a fast start. He birdies the first 2 holes, but you made a long one on the second hole as well. And you've always played aggressively. There never seemed to be any fear in your style of play, like Mr. Palmer always going for it no matter what. Was that the mentality? Did you ever have any fear that, you know, look, if I hit this putt, because if it rolls 3 or 4 feet past, who knows what happens? It never seemed like you said you had no negative thoughts on 18. It never seemed like you had a negative thought at all.
No, that was a good act by me. Of course, you know, as a golfer, you always have the heebie-jeebies sometimes, and negative thoughts creep through your mind. But the good news was I asked the R&A guy when we were heading or getting ready for the playoff. I said, I assume we're going back to 18. He says, no, we're going to 1. And I said, 1? That's a weird hole for a sudden-death playoff. It's like the easiest hole in the course. It's downwind. It's a driver and a 60-yard L wedge. He says, no, we're playing 1, 2, 17, and 18. And I had no idea. That was the first year of the 4-hole playoff. You know, like when you get to a tournament, you don't, the first thing you don't ask on Monday or Tuesday is you know, what's the playoff hole? You know, so it never crossed my mind. So that was kind of a relief. So that relaxed me. And then, of course, Greg birdied 1 again. as he did when he birdied the first six holes in the start of the fourth round. And then I made a 35 footer from the back of the green on two, but Greg poured it in again, made another birdie. I said, he's like, is he going to birdie every hole? And Wayne made a few pars, so it was 200-100 to even. And then Wayne bogeyed 17, and Greg and I both hit good shots into 17, the long par three. He hit it just over the green, and what I couldn't believe, and I still can't believe to this day, 35 years later, is he decided to chip it because he had one weed in front of his line. He was only a couple of feet over the green, and he chipped it with like a 7 or 8 iron. And I whacked my caddy on the shoulder. I was on the green. I marked my ball. And I said, my caddy's name was Drake. I said, Drake, can you believe he's chipping this? He says, no. And of course, he chipped it 10, 11, 12 feet by. And I lagged up there, almost made it. And then Greg missed. And then, of course, on 18, I hit a bad drive. And the reason I hit a bad drive, because back then I never hit 3-wood off the tee. But I knew that bunker was reachable. And so I kind of, because I was only 3 yards short of it in regulation on the 72nd hole. So I kind of flamed one out to the right in the rough. And so I moved off to the left side of the tee. And then when Greg teed off, he just blished one right down the middle with a slight fade. And Greg Rita, the great Greg Rita, caddy, unfortunately has passed away, said, beauty, Greg, and they started walking off the tee. I stood on the left side of the tee, and I kept watching this drive, and I thought to myself, if that kicks a little right, that could possibly catch that bunker that I almost hit it in regulation. Sure enough, it kicked right, and I kept watching it, bouncing and bouncing and bouncing and rolling. Back then, I could see good, and sure enough, I saw it catch the corner of that bunker, and he had no idea. And from that point on, I just walked up to my drive, was hoping I had a good lie, which I did. And the rough hit the 5-iron of my life. It looked like it was 2 feet from back in the fairway, but it was about 7 feet short. But that forced Greg to try to do something, miraculous. And of course, he hit it in the cross bunker. Hit it in the clubhouse, and then he just said, screw it, and picked up, and that was that. And then from that point on, I just, when I had the 7-footer and I knew I could 3-putt and win, I just told myself not to double hit it. If you watch the replay of the putt, I kind of short stroked it. I didn't yip it, but I didn't really follow through very far. It barely got to the hole and fell in, and that was that. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. So what was it like for you standing over that putt, knowing that you could 3-putt from that and you're going to win the Open Champion? You're about to be the Open Champion.
I think I was in a state of shock, quite honestly. And after that, I don't remember a thing I said in the speech. I remember calling my wife, who was due with our first kid, who turned out to be Brittany. We didn't know if it was a girl or a boy. She was due that day, Sunday of the Open, and obviously I made it home in time, and she was a couple weeks late. Actually, was born Tuesday at the PGA at Kemper Lakes, so I didn't go to that for that reason, but we named her Brittany, so that was and she's been there, and actually her and her now husband TJ got engaged that week when we were back 7 years ago or 8 years ago, they got engaged there, so that was pretty cool. And they put their names up on the board. Congratulations, Brittany Kalkovecki and TJ Amato, on your engagement. So that was really cool.
That is really cool. When the Open returned to Troon in 97, you were right back in the mix. You finished tied for 10th. Is there something about Troon that just fits your eye, or is the confidence level high because you've won on that golf course, so you know you can do it again?
A little of both, definitely. I played in the Scottish Open the week before 97 and played horrible. I made the cut, but I finished dead last. and was pretty down on my game. I wasn't hitting it good. I was putting terrible. And then when we rolled into a Royal Tour on Monday, all of a sudden I just felt great. Out of nowhere, I just felt great. I said, okay, this is where it all happens for me right here. This is my spot. I love it. And that happens to a lot of guys. You see, you know, the saying horses for courses or whatever, but you see it happen all the time. Guys, just certain players, certain golfers just love certain courses and areas, and you have good memories. You like the hotel, you like the restaurants. Everything just kind of clicks and falls into place. And that happens to me at Royal Trim. It's just a special place for me, and I love it there. It's as simple as that.
Mark, just a couple more before I let you go. And one of our listeners, Derek Jones, wanted me to ask you a question. With the course length staying relatively the same as it was back in 2016, and with conditions looking very wet for this weekend, could this be an older player's playground? Meaning, does this bring some of the older players back into the tournament if driving distance is less of a factor with wet conditions?
Well, that's a good question, Derek. I know there are a few new tees out there, but essentially it's the same course. When weather sets in, and you know, it's a factor. It's definitely a factor. But is it going to rain in the morning and not in the afternoon, or is it going to rain in the afternoon and not in the morning? So a little bit of luck is involved with the draw. But you know, I think the guys who are just generally grinders will do great in crappy weather if it is rainy and windy. It's going to be tough for everybody, but some of the older guys might have a little bit of an advantage over some of the younger guys for sure. But you just kind of got to wait and see what happens with the weather.
So who do you like this weekend? Who do you think's coming in playing really well and has a good chance to be this year's champion golfer?
Well, you know, of course, you always got to look at Scottie Scheffler. Obviously, number one in the world for a reason. Ludwig Åberg, Åberg, whatever. No one still knows how to pronounce his last name. It's only five letters. right? Åberg, I don't know. He's such an incredible talent and such a nice kid. It's unreal. I'm a huge fan of his. He's got to be in the mix. Shoffley's always solid. Morikawa, past champion. Rahm. Of course, Bryson. I mean, you can never discount Bryson with what he did at Pinehurst. So, there's five or six names that I think one of those guys is likely to win.
Mark, before I let you go, remind our listeners how they can stay up to date with all the great things you're doing. You're still out there playing on the Champions Tour. How can they follow you on social media?
I'm mostly on Twitter/X at Mark Kalk. Of course, follow my wife, Brenda Kalk, on Twitter X as well. She's funnier than I am. So we'll keep you updated on the latest in the golf world.
Mark, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come back and be a part of the show. You're absolutely one of my all-time favorites. I hope we get this privilege of catching up with you and Brenda sometime very soon.
Always, Chris. I don't think I'm going to catch Tom Patry at 100 shows, but you never know. keep calling me and keep asking me. You got me.
I appreciate it, and I'm going to do that. Take care, my friend. All the best to you and Brenda. We'll catch up soon.
All right, buddy. You got it. Thanks for having me.
See you, Mark. That is the great Mark Kalkovecchia. At Mark Kalk and at Brenda Kalk is how you can follow both of them on X or Twitter or whatever we're calling that these days. Two of the finest people that you'll ever meet. I can't thank both of them enough. They've come to mean the world to me. Mark has been on the show. I hope he gets to 100, and I'm going to try to make that happen. Tonight was number 9. Brenda's been on the show a couple of times as well, and I can't tell you how much I enjoy getting to speak to both of them and listening to their stories and their insights. Like I say, both just absolutely wonderful people. You won't meet better. So look forward to catching up with Mark and Brenda again here very soon. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on part one of this week's show. My sincere thanks again for the 100th time to Tom Patry. and a 1989 Open champion and a wonderful friend of the show, Mark Kalkovecki. You can't thank both of those guys enough for their stories and insights into this week's Open. Please come back for part two featuring my conversations with Jay Delsing, just one of the most positive people you'll meet in this life, and James Hong doing a wonderful job with our kids and the junior programs that he has established. We'll talk about all kinds of things with those guys, including the Open Championship and how to keep our kids interested in this game and making it one for a lifetime. Thank you all so much for being a part of this week's show. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.
Coming down the mountain, I take a breath of sin. Can't tell the day or time, but I know this day will end. On a mission I can't see, they say I am the one. In the end, it's you and me as we ride into the sun. So we ride another big thumb down the drag. We ride another day from the insane.
Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Hey, next on the T Nation, thanks for coming back for part two of this week's show featuring Jay Delsing and James Hong. Jay Delsing is a former All-American at UCLA. He was a two-time winner out on the Buy.com Tour. He had 30 top 10 finishes over the course of his PGA Tour career, and he is a member of both the St. Louis and Missouri Sports Hall of Fame. And on top of all of that, Jay is just one of the most positive people you will meet in this life. James Hong is one of the top U.S. kids teachers on the planet. There is a reason why U.S. Kids Golf has named him a lifetime master teacher. Golf Digest has also named him one of the best teachers in the state of New York, and he comes very highly recommended by both Tom Patry, which you heard in the beginning of this show back on segment one, plus Jeff Smith, one of the top instructors in our game. So I'm looking forward to having both of those guys as a part of the show. Jay Delsing is going to take us back through some of the great moments in his career. We'll also hear about his thoughts at the Open Championship and what he expects to see. We'll talk a little bit about something wonderful that he is doing with the Children's Miracle Network and his relationship as well with the Nicklaus family. James Hong will take us inside some of the programs that he has for our junior golfers that can help them not only learn the game of golf and appreciate the game of golf, but make it one for a lifetime as well. He'll also discuss why he always wanted to play catcher in baseball and how that translated into him becoming one of the best instructors in our game. Plus, he'll share some tips and some drills that we can do right at home that can help us play better golf. So sit back, relax, let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next hour or so. Before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom.
Go to 200.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2UNDR.com. 200, performance in your pants.
Every January, PGA Tour Superstore pros meet every manufacturer, learn about the latest equipment, log thousands of hours of training, and together hit over 100,000 balls, all so they can get you the perfect fit.
Okay, now joining me is Jay Delsing. Let me remind you a little bit about Jay's background. He's from St. Louis, Missouri. Like you heard Tom Patry say in the first segment, he was a tremendous junior golf player. He reached the quarterfinals of the U.S. Junior Championships in 1978. Jay played his college golf out at UCLA alongside Corey Pavin, Steve Pate, Tom Pernice Jr., and Duffy Waldorf. Jay lettered all 4 years there from 1979 to 1983 and was a two-time All-American. He helped them win back-to-back Pac-10 titles in 1982 and 83. He had 7 career college victories, and his 13 top 10 finishes and 55 career rounds are both still the most in UCLA history. He graduated with his degree in economics, earned his tour card in 1984. He won twice on what was then the Buy.com Tour at the 2001 Fort Smith Classic and the 2002 Omaha Classic. Plus, he shared the title at the 1993 Jerry Ford Invitational Celebrity Pro-Am with our good friend Donnie Hammond, plus Jim Thorpe. On the PGA Tour, he finished second at the 1993 New England Classic and the 1995 FedEx St. Jude Classic. He also had 3 third-place finishes, 11 top fives, and 30 top tens. In 2020, Jay was inducted into the St. Louis Sports Hall of Fame. In 2023, he was inducted into the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame as well. You've seen or heard Jay broadcasting tournaments for Fox Sports and PGA Tour Radio. He has his own radio show and podcast, which is fantastic. It's called Golf with Jay Delsing, and I couldn't be more honored. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Jay, thanks for coming back on the show.
Chris, my buddy, how are you, my man?
I'm fantastic, Jay. Tell me about you.
Oh, well, you know what, Chris? At my age, I'm going to unscrew the light bulbs in the bathroom and just brush my teeth in the dark because it's just getting ugly over here, buddy. Gravity is winning and Father Time is undefeated. So that's what it looks like. It's not pretty, bud. It's not.
Oh, I can't. I find that very hard to believe, Jay. Not only were you a great player, you look like you could have been a GQ model, probably still to this day.
Oh my gosh. Thank God you need glasses. I'm going to tell you something. I really appreciate you having me on the show. I can't wait to be with you. I got to tell you, you are such a light in the media world where we have so much vitriol and so much, oh gosh, whatever. And your positive outlook, and I'm a little that way myself, and I like hanging out with like-minded people. So whenever you call to ask me, I'm always glad to come on with you, pal.
Well, I appreciate all of that very much. And right back at you, my friend. I was talking to Mark Calcavecchia in the last segment. He obviously won the Open in 1989. You played in the Open Championship in 1995 at St. Andrews. What do you remember about your Open experience at the home of golf?
Oh, my gosh, Chris, it was great. But can I tell a Calc story first?
Please.
Okay, so, guys, I'm leading the Phoenix Open. Dang, I can't remember what year it is. Maybe it's 92. I don't know. I've got a one-stroke lead on Sunday. And we're walking off the sixth hole and playing with Mark Calc and Jim Thorpe. Great, great pairing. Love both of these guys. And we get to the 17th and Calc's having a rough day. He's 1 or 2 over par, Chris. And, you know, he was one of the most streaky individuals I've ever played with. When he was going well, he would absolutely run over you. And when he was going poorly, he would absolutely leave the building. You know what I mean? It could just go any sort of way. And the guy had so much talent, so much game. And we walk up to and Jim Thorpe's, I think about even, I don't know, but I've got a one-stroke lead. And we walk to the tee, and there are 6 groups on the tee. Somebody's lost the ball. Somebody's stuck in the cactus. Anyway, so we've got to regroup, my caddy and I, and we go back. And Calc was all but finished at this point. He was very frustrated that he got off to a bad start. And then I don't know where he went. I don't know where I went. But 45 minutes later, we wind up hitting our next shot. But to make a stupid long story really short, Kelk birdied 9 of the last 12 holes, Chris.
Wow. And
on 18, he hits it on the right hill, hits it 30 yards left and long of the green to that back hole location there at Scottsdale and holes it. And that's where I just bowed to him and I went, man, it was unbelievable. And you know, that's how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour. I think I wound up shooting 70 that day and finishing third or fourth, whatever, but not important because it wasn't a win. But it was amazing to watch him. It's like a switch just flipped, Chris, and he just turned into a different player. It was awesome.
I imagine it had to be awesome to watch. I mean, frustrating for you because you're leading the golf tournament, but on some level, you've got to be in awe of what the guy next to you is doing.
Well, I mean, eventually you have to tip your cap, right? I mean,
right.
You could say, well, you lost the tournament, or you can say, well, you know, he won the tournament. And we both are trying to do the same thing. And you do have to admire a guy. I mean, Kelk had so many wins and had such great upper end part of his game. You know, when he played well, he could go unconscious and just go really low. Always been one of my favorite guys. I'm glad to follow him here. But I just wanted to sneak that story in because Kelk was really a good champion and a good guy. He's honest. He's got a good sense of humor and a really, really fun guy, good champion.
Yes, indeed. So let's talk about your experience. What do you remember about 95?
I remember playing in the Scottish Open the week before. My buddy David Faraday set me up with a caddy. We were playing at Carnoustie, Chris. And I don't know if you've played Carnoustie or any of the listeners have played Carnoustie, but it is a bear. I mean, it is super, super tough. And I had a good tournament. I remember Faraday telling me, I got a caddy for you for that week. And I went over, so I was going to qualify for the British. And you know, they have that one kind of obscure qualification venue, Chris, that if you're not exempt, but you finish in the top 12 or so, I forget what it was, but you needed to finish in the top 12 of the tournament. And if you're not exempt, they take three players that could. And the long story short, I missed that by one stroke. So I wound up in like 13th or something. And I went into the qualifier and I qualified. It was really cool because it was a 36-hole qualifier at a little cool course down the road called Scotts Craig Link. And I went out there and I think I shot 9 under par. And what's interesting about their qualifier, Chris, is that it was 36 holes, similar to the U.S. Sectional qualifier for the U.S. Open, but they did theirs in 2 days. And I really think that benefits the better player because you've got a little more experience and it prevents that one player from having an unconscious day, you know, and getting in the championship. And so I qualified, and I'll never forget, Chris, I played my second round, and I think I shot 68, and I got my spot, and I finished playing. I got my certificate, and it was about 8:30 at night, and I drove over to St. Andrews, and I played 18.
Is that right?
Because, there's summers over there. It didn't get, I mean, I felt like that year it only got dark for like an hour.
Wow.
It was so crazy. I mean, it was so crazy. So I got in the tournament, Chris, and my Friday pairing, maybe it was Thursday, but my late pairing was 450. And so I was coming down, I'll never forget, every day at St. Andrews, I played there 4 days. I hit driver, putter, all 4 days. I drove it on the surface twice, and I drove it right on the fringe the other 2 times. And I remember looking up at the clock on the above the St. Andrews locker room and right there, and it was 9:05.
Ah.
And Chris, it was... You could play another 18 after that. It's crazy.
95 was also Mr. Palmer's final Open appearance. Did you get a chance at all to be around the King that week?
I did. I played right behind him in a pro-am. I mean, in the practice round, and he was playing with Jack and Tom and Raymond Floyd. And I was playing with, you know, some of my buddies. It was super cool. And then I went over to the, what do they call it? The British Open merch tent, it's like a village. I mean, Chris, it is the biggest thing you've ever seen. and there's all kinds of cool gear over there. And there was a rain suit company called ProQuip that if you played in the championship, they would give you this rain gear. And back then, we didn't have greatest rain gear. And I had seen the ProQuip stuff, so I went over to claim my suit. And Arnold Palmer was in there. Mr. Palmer was there. So I got to talk to him. I had played with him several times before. But, man, you want to talk about kind and want to talk about remembering your name and asking you how you're playing. And I asked him how his day went. And he goes, well, I don't know. It went okay because I got a little bit of Jack Nicklaus money in my back pocket. So, he was always such a competitor. And I've got a picture of him. I sent him a picture of himself on the Spokane Bridge to get signed. And Chris, he passed before he was able to sign it. So I still have the picture frame in my office with an empty photo because it still was memorable for me, you know, to be able to send to Mr. Palmer. It's kind of crazy, but super, super cool.
Also in 95, that was the year John Daly won it after that unbelievable putt on the 72nd hole that Constantino Rocca made from the Valley of Sin to force a playoff. Did you stick around at all to see how the tournament was going to play out?
I did. I was right there. And you know whose locker was right next to mine was Constantino Rocca. You would think John Daly because Delsing and Daly, but I don't know. I got my locker was right next to Constantino and he came in and shook his hand. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. You know, he was not that well known of a player to nearly win the Open Championship. Man, that was amazing golf down the stretch and super exciting to watch, and especially getting to watch it from the home of golf. Hell, Chris, I'm a caddy, man. I grew up as a caddy up in North County here, and my perspective comes from that caddy point of view. And I was pinching myself to be able to be sitting in that locker room and all that other stuff. It was cool.
Jay Scottie Scheffler is the odds-on favorite this week. His best finish in an Open is tied for seventh back in 2021. He finished tied for 21st in 2022, tied for 23rd last year. I know he's put together an historically great season so far this year, but do you feel like he's the favorite to you?
You know what? You know what? I will refrain from that. I mean, if we were playing on a more American style course, Chris, I would absolutely say look out for Scottie Scheffler. But you're and I'm sure Calc mentioned it when you talked to him too. When you go to the play overseas, the weather can dictate so much. Scottie Scheffler's a big, tall guy. I'm a couple inches taller than he is, but there's not that many people over six foot three that have played professional golf. And when you get playing out in the wind, it's a lot. As a tall player, it's a lot. So I'm going to, depending on the weather, if we get calmish conditions, I'm going to look for Scottie Scheffler. If we don't, I'm not going to look for him. Not that he's not tough and not that he's not that built that way, but you got to have a certain mutter quality to you to compete over there, because when the going gets rough over there, Chris, it gets impossible because you get wind, you get rain, you get the crazy bounces. And I really think that sort of weather is going to favor a European player. Robert McIntyre is playing out of his mind. After reading what he said about why he was late for his Open Championship press conference, maybe he'll still be hungover and won't play that well. But I absolutely love this kid. I love the story about he and his father winning the RBC Canadian Open Championship. It's absolutely fantastic. I personally would love to see Rory win. I don't think that's in the cards. I just have a feeling I don't see that in the cards. I love anything that Bryson DeChambeau does. Playing in heavy wind is going to really complicate things for him, I think, because it just adds to so many more calculations. And, you know, the way he just dissects a golf course is challenging as hell anyway for a knucklehead like me. But for when you throw in rain and wind and all those other things, Chris, it gets pretty tough. I'm looking for somebody from LIV to start playing better, Chris, just because, you know, they've got a lot of really good players over there, but it just makes me wonder, do the three rounds, you know, just inhibit your ability to stay sharp and ready? I don't know. So you look at Koepka, you look at a kid named Joaquin Niemann from Chile. He's He's a wonderful talent. From the U.S. side, I mean, I love Xander Schauffele getting the monkey off his back, winning so beautifully like he did at Valhalla. I look for him. I look for Ludwig Ober. I'm not exactly sure how the hell to pronounce this kid's name, but I would take anything. I love this kid. I'm a huge fan of his. I love his pre-shot routine. Chris, he's one of the first players that keeps moving through their pre-shot routine, a la Brad Faxon when he was putting. And so there's a real rhythm to everything he does. He's a big kid. He's strong. So, you know, it's probably going to come out of those guys like there, Schauffele, Scheffler, possibly Rory, maybe some European guy, something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the list you ran off are all the guys that I think are going to be near the top of the leaderboard. I also like Shane Lowry to win over there because he's used to all of those things, right? Because one of the things you talk about is weather. And because that does sort of shade towards a European player, because they're used to the wind and the rain and all of that sort of thing, I think they're mentally tougher, perhaps because they're used to, they play in it all the time, right? I mean, that's just what it's like over there to play. Now, you mentioned, you know, Scotty, and I think a guy that plays in Texas that's used to playing in windy conditions has a really good chance because that doesn't faze you either. I think once you start getting into playing out there in the sideways rain and that sort of thing, it plays into a mental toughness game. And if you're used to playing in it, to your point, I think that's where the European players have a bit of an edge over a U.S. player.
100%. Chris, remember back in the day, the Euros would come over and they would dominate at Augusta. Seve won twice. Bernard won twice. Olazabal won twice. Fowler won twice. Those guys know how to keep the ball on the ground. And they've learned. They used to not compete worth a darn in the U.S. Open because it was the high rough. It was the lob shot. Those guys, and to your point, Chris, and you said it beautifully, those European guys know how to keep the ball on the ground. They know how to manage and maneuver around all that crazy over there where the U.S. players don't. And I do believe you're right. I like a European player being a little bit hardier than the U.S. player in those type of conditions.
Jay, a couple more before I let you go. And Tiger continues to say in his press conferences that he feels like he can still win. This is only the fifth tournament that he is going to be playing in this calendar year. The other four were, as we know, a withdrawal, a last place, and two missed cuts. I don't know. Your thoughts on Tiger's ability to realistically go out there and win? Because if you're only playing in one tournament a month or four or five tournaments a year, I don't care how great you've been over the course of your career, you got to get out there and get the reps. I just don't like his ability to show up once a month over a 4 or 5 month span and still think he has an opportunity to win, even as great as he's been.
I love what you're saying, buddy. And I totally, wholeheartedly, and I'm going to come out with a super strong statement that he can't win. Okay. And I am going to be the first person you call when he makes me eat my words, because I will love that. I would be great for the sport. I love Tiger Woods. I love watching everything he does, but you're 100% right, Chris. And look at what's let him down in the last couple of events that he's played in. All of his bread and butter, his short game, his pitching, his chipping, it's been extremely mediocre. And because those, you can sit there and hit balls and you can work on your golf swing, but you can't make those pressure 4, 5, 6, 8 footers that when all of a sudden your heart's pounding and your pulse is racing, your knees are knocking, your hands are a little sweaty. All the things that Tiger recognized and admitted to this week when he was talking about, you know, what it's like trying to win championships. And without that, you just forget what it takes. It is so demanding. He's done it almost better than anybody else, but not quite. And I just don't like it. It pains me to not watch him play. It almost also pains me to watch him play because it looks like he's got so little power in his lower half anymore, Chris. He doesn't use the ground anymore. He was so powerful as a youngster and had that long swing and all those long limbs, but he used the ground so much. And now because of the accidents, he's unable to. So I think that and the lack of reps, his putting and short game are not world class anymore. It pains me to say it. I don't think he can do it.
Day one more, and the Children's Miracle Network has asked you to be their local chair for their event there in St. Louis. A tremendous honor for you, a guy that's been named to the St. Louis Sports Hall of Fame, the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame. This has got to be a tremendous honor that's, I'm sure, not quite to that level, but still fantastic.
Oh, Chris, you're so right. And look, listen, it is so special. Barbara and Jack Nicklaus, forget about the first family of golf. Forget about the best player of all time. Forget about all that. When it comes to human beings, these people are all aces. And Barbara Nicklaus and Jack started this Play Yellow initiative. Since 2004, Chris, Jack and Barbara, and I've had them both on my show separately, and I had to get Barbara on because I'm such a fan, and I wanted to know how she did it. Like, how did you stay married? How did you keep all of those children going and all that and be such a rock star? And all you have to do is listen to her talk, and you're like, oh, you just have this thing about you that makes you so special. But since 2004, she and Jack have raised over $250 million, Chris, for children's charities. And they're a walking, talking societal powerhouse, those two people. And when Children's Miracle Network came to me and explained to me what they were doing and explained to me that I was going to chair this golf event, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm more than honored to do this. I had to talk to Barbara about that on the show, and she explained how the whole Yellow came through and that story with the young man who was terminally ill in Ohio, and then Jack in 86 wearing that yellow shirt, he pulls it out of the, you know, pulls it out of the suitcase and looks at Barbara, and she goes, why not? You know, and I could just hear those two people saying that. So it means the world to me. We raised quite a bit of money, and the Children's Miracle Network, the girls are Melissa and her team, they do all the work. I show up and help them raise a little bit of money, but it's an honor for me, man. It's terrific.
Dave, before I let you go, remind our listeners again how they can stay up to date with all the great things you're doing. Listen to your show, plus follow you online and on social media.
I'm trying to catch up to you, man, and all these awards you win. Congratulations again on winning the award. It's so well-deserved. Your show is so well done. We're trying to catch you. We're trying to learn from you. My show is called Golf with Jay Delsing. We do it on Sunday mornings here locally on ESPN. You can do the 101 ESPN app. It's from 8 to 10. We do a two-hour show locally, and that's heard in probably a little four-state area here. Where I'm also on 55 stations around the country where we're syndicated now. So it's in a market somewhere close to you. It's called Golf with Jay Delsing. You can reach out to me at my website at jdelsinggolf.com. Ask me a question about your game. Send me a video. Do anything. I love helping people. I want to grow the game. And I love being on your show, man. And I can't believe Patrick's been on this thing 100 times. What in the hell's going on with you? You guys related?
You would think, well, you know, we're both paisans. He's a Goomba. So, you know, together, yeah. You know, we got that going for us, but. Yeah, he's I don't know guy. if it's great or I'm mentally ill. One of those things is what it
is. It's I'm going to answer that question for you. It's great. He's great. I love Tom. Tom is another one of the positive forces in the country and in the world, man. And he shines a light. It's awesome. And yeah, I don't know how many times I've been on, but whenever you call, I'm glad to come on. And you know, I just appreciate you thinking of me and having.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Jay. You're fantastic. One of my favorites. You are one of the positive people out there. That's why I enjoy having you on the show like I do. And I'm certainly appreciative of what you're putting out there and the content that you deliver. You're just a you know, you talk about radiant lights. You're a bright light in our game, and you have been for a very long time. Continue to do what you do. I appreciate you very much.
Same. Thank you for the kind words, my friend. Keep well.
All right. Take care, Jay. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Chris.
See you, Jay. That is the great Jay Delsing. JDelsingGolf.com is the website. At Jay Delsing Golf is where you can find him on social media and his show. Like he said, Golf with Jay Delsing, 101 ESPN Radio. You can find it 8 to 10 on Sundays and syndicated around the countries. Jay, and I mean this sincerely, one of the things I love about Jay, and I've, you know, as we have talked over the years and had some synergies, is just how extremely positive Jay always is. It's always an excitement in his voice and his attitude. When you listen to his show, that comes through as well. That's why people love going on his show and being a part of it. That's why you get a Jack and a Barb and Nicholas to come on there, because of just what a wonderful person Jay is. And that comes through when every conversation that you have with him. So that's what makes his show great. That's what makes him great. And that's what makes me so appreciative that I've gotten to have him as a part of the show over the years as well. And hopefully we get to continue to have that privilege. And I'll try to ping Jay again, maybe a little bit later on in the summer or the fall, and we'll get more of his positivity, because we can just never get enough of that. So my thanks to Jay. We'll catch up with him soon. Coming up next is a guy, like I said earlier in the show, is a guy who is one of the top U.S. Kids instructors. There's a very good reason why he is a U.S. Kids Golf Lifetime Master Teacher, and that is James Hong. Before I bring James into the show, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speed Bolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com.
Frustrated with your golf game? Imagine playing with total confidence. Join me, LPGA Pro and golf mindset expert Debbie O'Connell, for my Conquer Your Golf Mind Challenge. Bill cuts 6 strokes and Lori is club champion. What's your goal? Click the link or text NEXT to 727-339-0106. Use code NEXT for $20 off. Your tee time for transformation is now. Will you take the shot?
Now making his next On the Tee debut with me is James Hong. Let me give you a little bit of background on James. He is the Director of Instruction at Harbor Links Golf Course in Port Washington, New York. He is also a U.S. Kids Golf Lifetime Master Teacher, TPI Golf Professional, and one of Golf Digest's best teachers in the state of New York. Golf Magazine named him one of their top 100 teachers to watch. He has also been named by Golf Range Association of America as a top 50 growth of the game teaching professional. He came highly recommended by another one of the top instructors in our game and a recent guest here on the show, Jeff Smith. And if Jeff says he's great, he must be great. So I'm very excited I get to have James with me here on Next on the Tee. Hey, James, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
James, when I was talking to Jeff after the last time he was on the show, he said, you got to have James Hong on the show. He's creative. He's funny. He's thoughtful. And did I mention he loves donuts? I feel like there's a story behind the donut. He said that. What's that backstory?
Yeah, actually, you know, that's just a sly thing that Jeff does. Is he, you know, he passes all of this on to me, knowing that I'm going to turn it away. And now he's got a whole supply of donuts for himself. That's what it's really about. And I have video, I have pictures, I have evidence stacked a mile high to prove it.
That's awesome. Now, I'm not surprised to hear that's the story, by the way. James, let's start with your journey in the game of golf. I heard that you got into the game because your best friend started asking your dad about golf, and you thought, hey, wait a minute here. So you started talking to your dad about it, and then you ended up getting hooked. Is that how it happened?
That's exactly what it was. I think I was like 9 years old or something like that at the time. And my dad was learning how to play golf. And one of my best friends was over. We'd be, you know, spending the summer together, hanging out and stuff like that. And, you know, I'd get a little jealous because he's spending more time asking my dad about how to hold a golf club and all of these things. And, you know, back in the day, like golf was supposed to be for old people. It wasn't supposed to be for kids like us. And it's like, hey, you know, we're supposed to be playing wiffle ball. We're supposed to be doing like playing whatever, stick ball in the street or something. And you're asking about holding a golf club. It's like, what's going on here? And then, but like you said, it's like, I started thinking about it too and going like, well, he's getting a lot of attention from my dad. So I started asking about it. And sure enough, you know, at some point I just got hooked on it myself.
I saw that you also played baseball and other sports as a kid. And when you were playing baseball, you wanted to play catcher, because you could tell the other players where they should be positioned, kind of like a coach out there on the field. Is that where your desire to go on and be a PGA professional and being an instructor, is that where it got born from?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that seemed to have been ingrained in me my whole life. My father was a college professor. And so just having that sense of what it's like to be a teacher is just was something that I experienced daily. And whatever sports I was in, it was always one of those things about watching coaches and stuff. And remember, in those days, there was no social media. There was nothing like that. So you would always hear stories. Everything was hearsay, you know, urban legend. And you'd hear these great stories about coaches and what they would say in the locker room. And then you'd hear about they wouldn't just talk about the star players. They would talk about the sixth guy, the first guy off the bench and all that stuff and what made them special. And it just made me more and more interested in not just in what it is to play a sport, but also what coaches are looking for. You know, like what the grittiness of the player and all those kind of things. So yeah, that really got ingrained in me. And as I grew up and played sports, it's like I would do the same thing. I would always be watching the other players and watching my teammates and kind of pointing things out. And I remember it was even to the point where I would be telling people on the other team what I saw, and my coaches would get pissed at me. They're just like, "What are you doing?" And it's like you're helping the other side here beat you. And I was like, "Yeah, I couldn't help it."
That's awesome. As a U.S. kids instructor, what's harder for you to do? Start working with a kid who we as parents have ingrained in them something that just isn't right about the golf swing, or the expectations that we have as parents that, you know what, our son or daughter is going to be the next Tiger Woods or Annika Sorenstam, kind of setting our expectations right? What's harder for you to do?
Yeah, I think it's the latter part. It's the expectations that parents think that their child is the next Annika or a Tiger. And it's not that they're necessarily wrong, but I don't think they quite understand the path that it takes to get to that level, let alone be one of the greatest of all time. And so one of the things I always talk about with people is how we know where we see where the kid is right now, and we see where they could be at some point. But we think that's like a one-step approach, and it's not. It's a process. It's a long-term process, and it's a bumpy one at that. And parents tend to see only the results, the end results of seeing someone like Tiger Woods winning majors or Annika winning all of her tournaments and whatnot, and they don't realize the hard work that was put in, and not just the hard work, but the process of failing and learning from the failures.
To that end. Right. I mean, you don't want to tamp down a kid's dream because someone could end up being great that day. How do you set expectations with both the player and the parents when they first start taking up the game?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I try to get across right from the start is that we have to understand this is a game of failure. This is not a game of success. If it was a game that was meant to be successful or easy, fairways would look like runway airports. The hole would be the size of a manhole cover, et cetera. There wouldn't be anything like bunkers and whatnot. So it's more about managing your failures, managing successes, and success is so fleeting in the game that we have to understand that sometimes a mediocre shot is good enough, and understanding those things and learning from what we're experiencing. And I think what happens a lot with parents is they think that their child should not be making mistakes, or what they do is they only see the good shots. They only see their children hitting a perfect 7-iron or a perfect driver. And they don't realize that the 7 or 8 balls that your child hooked or sliced or whatever, that your child potentially is going to learn more from those shots than from the perfect shot they just hit.
How do you teach kids when they first start to play and they've gone through the kind of the basics, the beginning part of it, but then start to actually get out on the golf course? How do you teach them to play the game of golf and not play golf swing?
So what I do is I put them in the situations on the golf course. Usually I might start from, let's say, 30 yards out and just kind of give them a sense of maybe almost like playing a game within a game, where I might say, what is your target score from here? And what I mean by that is what is an acceptable score? Let's say it's for a beginner, let's say it's 3 to get it in the hole from there. And what is the worst score that you find acceptable? So it might be, if I can get this ball in the hole in 5 shots or less from here, I'm satisfied. That's what I need. Anything 5 or lower is good enough from here. And playing it that way versus, is your wrist angle correct? Is your stance correct? Is the technique perfect? Do you look good here? Do you look like Rory McIlroy or something like that? And it takes their mind off of that and just realizing that, hey, it's about getting the ball in the hole in as few shots as possible.
So let's take that a half a step further, because at some point we've got to learn, to your point, about strategy. And sometimes you got to take your medicine. Instead of, if we're playing on a par four, instead of letting 6 or 7 come into the equation, you've got to learn that it's okay sometimes to take 5 and move on, just so you don't end up having a blow up kind of hole. How do you teach the kids from a strategic perspective? You got to hit the next shot wherever you hit the previous one too. How do you get them to kind of settle down and go, okay, 5 is okay here, so that I don't end up ruining my round?
Yeah, it's just one of those things where when we go out on the golf course, every hole, we might be emphasizing that. So, for example, a player may have had a really good drive and then hit their second shot onto the green. I will go up there onto the green and pick up their ball and throw it into the bunker. And I will create those scenarios for them. And they look at me like, why'd you do that? And I'll tell them, it's like, because you're 15 feet from the hole. We know you're going to 1-putt or 2-putt. That's not what we're here for. It's realizing that, what if you didn't hit the green? What if you have a 60-foot putt? Or what if you're in the bunker? Or what if you're just short of the green? And understanding, what is an acceptable score from here? How is managing your play from here so that we avoid the doubles or the triples or whatever it is? And especially for the kids that play competitively, I point out to them, when you look at either the winner or the top 5 players in that tournament, look at their scorecards. They have, for 18 holes, 5 or 6 bogeys. They've got them there. But what you'll notice is you will rarely see the doubles or the triples. And that's what they have to learn, that every once in a while, a bogey is okay, as long as it's not a double.
James, for kids in a world where we have such short attention spans, it's an Xbox, Instagram, TikTok kind of world nowadays. How do you keep the kids engaged, excited, interested, and coming back to make golf not a game for just like right now, but make it a game for a lifetime?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I do for them is, I'm like that myself. I have a short attention span. And so what I've done is hopefully created some ways to practice, some drills where they don't feel like they have to hit 300 balls on the driving range or make 1,000 3-footers on the putting green. It's like, some of the things that I've shown the kids on how to practice is, hey, if you do this the way I'm telling you, you really only need to do this for 5 minutes. You only need to do that for 10 minutes. And it kind of almost has a reverse effect on it, where when they do those exercises and they see how simple it is or how easy it is, they actually they want to stay in that process longer. And they'll ask me, it's like, well, can I do it for 20 minutes? Can I do it for 10? Can I do it for longer than that? And I say, well, of course you can. There's nothing wrong with that. So it's almost like reverse psychology in that you're accepting the fact that their attention span is short. And because you're doing that, you're piquing their interest. And all of a sudden they turn it around. And they want more.
You wrote a piece for Golf Digest back in May of 2020. So during the time when we were in the throes of the pandemic, and everyone was still social distancing and all that sort of thing. But you gave some tips that I still think are valid to this day, because you talked about the importance of staying positive, giving people encouragement and something positive to focus on, and not being victimized by the situation. I still think that's a great message to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in fact, it's interesting you brought that up just the other day. And I've been using this exact example with a lot of the students over the last week or so, because in the summertime here, this is the tournament season for a lot of them. And I've been talking about this where about a week ago, I went out and I played with this young man who plays on his college golf team. And of course, you know, these guys, they hit it so far. He hits his 3-wood farther than I hit my driver. And we're out there on one of the holes, and I'm setting up to a shot from 152 yards uphill. And I literally, no exaggeration, cold topped it about 40 yards. And I'm standing there and he's looking at me going like, did you do that on purpose? And I looked at him, I was like, why would I do that on purpose? And we're laughing. And then he's setting up to a shot. And as he's setting up, I say, you know what's amazing? What's really good about that? Where that ball ended up is exactly my line. That's exactly the line I took, which is telling me my club face was dead square. That makes me happy. That means if I swung half an inch lower, I'd probably be up there putting for birdie. That's really good. I'm happy about that. And he looked at me, he goes, do you seriously think that way? And I said, absolutely. And he goes, if you were playing in a tournament, would you think that way? And I said, even more so, because why would I want to denigrate myself under a competitive situation like that, high pressure situation? When we go out there and play, there's two things that we're fighting. We're fighting the golf course and we're fighting ourselves. And the golf course is always going to win. So there's nothing we can do about that. But if we're fighting a losing battle against ourselves, we have no shot. So I'm always trying to take the good out of the bad. And he looked at that and he goes like, wow, you know, I gotta learn to be more like that. And you know, hopefully that was a good example, not just for him, but for some of the other kids that I teach.
That is a fantastic example. Kudos to you for speaking that and starting to ingrain that into the young players, because that's going to come back and do that player some good at some point in his or her career as they continue to play the game. So that's awesome. James, you have taught so many young players and helped fuel their dreams. When you get some quiet moments to yourself, it has to be very fulfilling to see some of the progress that those kids have made, whether they've gone on to play high school golf or college golf, win junior tournaments, what have you. Are there some things that your students have said to you that have really touched your heart?
Yeah, I mean, I can think right away of a couple instances where I was in the pro shop here at the golf course a few months ago, and I just happened to be standing there by the computer looking at the tee sheet, and I saw a familiar name, and I was like, hey, I think that guy was in one of our programs or one of our camps when he was a kid. And sure enough, he comes walking through the door to check in and he sees me and we're chatting and stuff. And he's, of course, like not just, you know, graduated from college, but he's got his own family now. And he's like, you know, how the camps and everything like that. And as he's walking out the door, he turns around and he says, you know, those summers that we were together in the camps were the best summers I ever had in my life. And he walked out the door and everyone in the pro shop, it was like one of these dramatic moments where it's like, wow. And I had a lump in my throat. And, you know, I went over and I went to the teaching staff because some of them, we've been together for so long. I brought it up with them. Hey, remember this kid? And, you know, that was one. And you know, I remember another young lady telling me about how all of those nights she would be in college and she had to pull all-nighters studying for final exams or something like that. And she would say that she would remember those times she was working on her game, and she would always tell herself, if I could get through that, the difficulty of learning how to hit that flop shot or that one shot that it was giving me so much havoc on the golf course, I can get through this. And, you know, it's those moments that really kind of stand out for me, because that example of what I just gave you, that happened about 15 years ago, and it's still fresh in my mind.
Wow. That is a wow moment, and that's fantastic. Kudos to you for making that kind of impression on a young person. Couple more before I let you go. You also created some tips for practicing in the house, whether it's in the basement, the garage, the hallway, outside in the backyard during that pandemic time, but it's still great tips that we can utilize today. You set up some paper plates inside and pool noodles outside to help us figure out how to hit the ball a certain distance and repeat that over and over again. Do you mind sharing that tip?
Yeah, one of the things I did was, and my wife wasn't happy about this, I grabbed a bunch of fry pans from the pantry as well as some paper plates, and I went out to the backyard and I laid them out in the backyard as to represent landing areas for chipping and pitching, and would start to chip balls to them. And of course, with the fry pans and everything, you'd hear them like clang off the pan. And she'd be like, you know, we're going to have to get new fry pans because I'm not using this anymore. And, but you know, some stuff like that, because what it was doing with, especially with the fry pans, the pots, was it was giving you that audible feedback. And so, especially at that time where we were stuck in the house, we couldn't even hang out with anybody or meet anybody. It's just doing anything that was amusing was good enough for us at that time. So that was something that I came up with. And the other one with the pool noodles was just working on things like start line. Can you hit the ball to the right? If you're putting an alignment stick in the ground vertically and then covering it with a pool noodle, it's can you hit the ball to the right of it? Can you hit the ball to the left of it? So you're learning how to control club face. And also putting the pool noodle horizontally so that can you chip or pitch balls or even full swings? Can you hit it over the pool noodle? Can you hit it under? So obviously over would be full shots and under would be knockdowns or punch shots. And just learning to be creative with your practice. Because again, hitting balls in the backyard, it's you're not going to be doing that for 2 hours. You're not going to be doing that for 3 hours. So little short spans where you're hitting 15 balls, 20 balls would be good enough to help improve your game.
James, we'd be remiss if we didn't circle back to Jeff Smith, like again, who was one of the best instructors on the planet and an all-around great guy. How did the two of you meet?
Well, it was interesting in that we actually met through social media at first, and we'd be commenting on each other's posts and stuff, or we would be private messaging each other. And all of a sudden, one day at the PGA show, every year we have the open forum there, which is a big golf instructors powwow every Tuesday at the PGA merchandise show. And he had offered his services to help out. And so that's how I met him in person, that we finally got to meet face to face. And it was one of those things where if anybody's ever met Jeff, it's like 5 minutes after meeting him, you feel like he's one of your best friends. And he just has a knack of making everyone feel very comfortable. And he's an amazing guy. He's a great guy. And so it was one of those things where, like I said, 5 minutes after meeting him for the first time, I felt like I'd known him for 20 years already.
Before I let you go, James, let our listeners know, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're doing, whether it's following you, it's online, or we're doing it on social media?
On social media, you can follow me on Instagram at James Hong Golf. So that's James and then Hong, H-O-N-G, golf. And on Facebook, it would be James Hong and also James Hong Golf. So you could see me on all three of those. I'm not on TikTok. I haven't figured that out yet. I must be an old fart or something like that. But you know, one of these days, maybe I'll figure it out, but not yet.
Well, James, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come and be a part of the show. You're fantastic, my friend. I hope we get this privilege again soon.
Oh, thank you for having me. I was really honored to get your invitation.
James, take care. All the best to you and your family. I look forward to catching up with you again, like I say, hopefully sometime very soon.
Same to you, Chris. Take care.
You too, James. That is James Hong. How great is that guy? Be sure to give him a follow on Instagram, like he said, at James Hong Golf. You can also check him out on the Harbor Links website as well. Try to book a lesson with him there, maybe. Simply, it's harborlinks.com/instructors is where you can find him there. But like I say, when Jeff Smith said to me, you got to have this guy on the show, he's fantastic. I would certainly take anything that Jeff said to me to the bank, and you could see why, right? I mean, he was exactly dead on. James is fantastic. He's doing great things with U.S. kids and our junior players. And those junior players are growing up to be wonderful players and doing great things, I'm sure. And when you come back and you hear the impact that is carried with James from a player that said some great things to him 15 years ago about how they translated not only their golf game, but that into studying for their finals and doing other things in life, how you take the lessons learned that James has prepared them to do, that's powerful. That is what this is all about, right? I mean, look, we're not all going to be Tiger Woods and Annika Sorenstam. We're going to be wonderful players in our own right, maybe at a club level or a city level or just with our buddies. But to be able to take those lessons and translate them to other things is what is wonderful about our game. And James is just one of the wonderful teachers that is out there doing great things with junior golf. And I'm sure that he's going to continue to do that for many years to come. And I hope that we get that blessing to continue to learn along with him about the lessons he is teaching junior players that we as parents, when we have junior players, that we can also keep in mind and learn from and set expectations and, and help our young players develop as well. So kudos to James for being one of the top U.S. Kids instructors. There's a reason why he's a lifetime master teacher with U.S. Kids and one of Golf Digest's best teachers in the state of New York. Kudos to him. We'll catch up with him again soon. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this week's edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks go out to Tom Patry, Mark Calcavecchia, Jay Delsing, and James Hong for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are 1991 Open champion Ian Baker Finch will make a return visit to the show. Excited to catch up with Ian. It's been a little bit. One of the guys who's quickly becoming a great friend of this show, and that is two-time winner on PGA Tour, John Inman, will be back with me, as will one of the great hockey color analysts and Mura golf ambassador, Darren Pang, will make a return visit with me here on Next on the Tee. Very excited to have Panger back on the show as well. And then we'll round things out, crossing over to baseball with former Pirates and Padres infielder Kurt Bavacqua. Dirty Kurt is what they used to call him because he always got his uniform dirty. You might remember Kurt was, they used to have a bubblegum blowing contest. There's made cards of it back in the mid-70s, and Kurt was a big winner with one of those things as well, and just a fantastic guy. We always enjoyed him so much over on the football side on Thursday Night Tailgate when he would come on, and we'd do the crossover to baseball. So looking forward to having Kurt as part of the show. So it's going to be a really fun one next week, folks. I hope you'll come back and be a part of it with us. Want to thank my friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for hosting this show on their site. You can find it by going to triblive.com. And then clicking on the sports section tab, you'll find the most recent episode front and center for you there. Or you can click on sports and then podcasts, and then you're going to see the Next on the Tee logo. Click on that, and all the shows from this season are available for you free right there on that site. You can also find the show over on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, and Player.fm. And like I say every week, my sincere thanks to the folks at Good Pods for making Next on the Tee one of the recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But most of all, my sincere thanks go out to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you all so very much. Until next week, hit them straight, my friends.